Hello and welcome to Volume 13 of Capital Ideas Live. In the last 10 years, we've seen many changes in the demographics of the state and of its land use. Many counties in Alabama have witnessed significant population growth with a robust economy present throughout much of the 1990s. During the first half of the decade, the timber market was so healthy that many worried that chip mills, which located in Alabama, would consume all of the timber in sight. In this issue, we'll discuss with Jim Gober what has happened to the timberland and to timber during the go-go 90s. We'll also discuss matching the right hardwood to the right site. We'll discuss risks inherent in timberland, how a banker looks at timberland as an investment, the federal government's offer to help preserve timberland by buying it, a new idea for reducing one's taxes, a magazine for portable sawmillers, and how the timber market is behaving. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel for the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Let's begin our discussion with Jim Gober. Welcome, Jim.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
You're with the Alabama Forestry Commission, and you've been conducting an inventory of the forest in Alabama. Can you tell me first just the procedure that the commission goes through to inventory an entire state's forest?
Well, the forest inventory is a systematic inventory of Alabama's forest lands, not just Alabama's, but the nation's. The survey belongs to the U.S. Forest Service, and the state foresters over the years have been in partnership with the U.S. Forest Service to conduct the survey. This time around, the Alabama Forestry Commission is actually responsible for measuring and gathering survey plot data, and we have 9 certified crew leaders and 3 assistants. They're all foresters working across the state day in and day out visiting the plots, and these are permanent plots. In fact, the Forest Service has conducted this survey for the past 65 years, and we just completed the 7th visit to those plots. And there are approximately 5,600 plots across the state. They're on a 3-by-3-mile grid. Each FIA plot represents approximately 6,000 acres.
Is there an agency that's responsible for assuring that the data that's collected is of the highest quality?
Well, again, it is a Forest Service survey, so whatever work we do, we have to meet their standards. The Forest Service has overall quality assurance responsibility, and they require each of our surveyors to be trained and certified. In fact, our surveyors are required to do 6 weeks of training, and after we begin our work, they actually come in behind us and do check plots. And, of course, they don't tell us which plots they're going to check behind us. And our surveyors have to maintain an average annual score of 87%. And if they fall below that 87%, by the end of the year, they are required to be recertified.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know the process is not yet complete, but what can you tell us about the trends that you're observing in the data that you do have?
Well, we have 6 units, Forest Service units. They divide the 67 counties up into 6 units. 4 of those units are reporting out now. We just completed the survey back in December of 2000. We're beginning to get some preliminary data. And the trends are very good over what they were in the past. And what we're seeing is across those 4 units, and I'm talking about primarily about 2/3 of the state from North Alabama, west side of Alabama, down to Mobile, we're seeing about a 3.5% increase in the amount of timberland, forest land available based on over what it was in 1990, the last survey done. And also, we're seeing an increased growing stock volume for softwood in terms of cubic foot volume. We're seeing a 9% increase across those 4 units, and also a 22% increase for hardwood cubic volume growing stock as well. So those trends are good, and they're preliminary, but they certainly are good news.
So just to summarize, you're seeing an increase in timberland by 3%.
An average across the 4 units.
And on growing stock for both softwood and hardwood, you're seeing an increase, with a dramatic increase in the growing stock of hardwood.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you very much for that, Jim. We appreciate it.
Well, Thank you.
Well, some of the increase in timberland and hardwood volume may be attributable to converting cropland to forest use. Our next guest is Steve Meadows with the U.S. Forest Service. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Hayes. Glad to be here.
Steve's joining us from Stoneville, Mississippi. Steve, your area of focus is on bottomland hardwoods and specifically matching the right hardwood to the right site. Tell us why that's so important.
Well, most of our hardwood species that we have are pretty site-specific species. In other words, they survive and they grow well only on certain kinds of sites. So what we end up with is a pretty wide variety of species out there that are available to plant, and these species have a wide variety of requirements, ecological requirements, and we have a wide variety of sites available. So it's extremely important to match the species to the site. In other words, to plant the right species on the right site. And if we don't do that, we can end up with a loss of productivity or even a complete plantation failure.
Mm-hmm. Well, we often have a lot of information about growing pines, but your focus is on hardwoods, and apparently there's a little more thought that needs to go in matching the right species to the right site.
That's correct.
Well, are there any tools out there that a landowner could use to determine what species is adapted to whatever site he happens to have?
Well, we do have a system for site evaluation that was developed here at Stoneville a number of years ago by Jim Baker and Walt Broadfoot. And so we commonly call it the Baker-Broadfoot method, and it was developed back in the late 1970s, and we can use that system to estimate site index for as many as 14 different hardwood species on any kind of site, whether it's a cutover site or an old field site. And the Baker-Broadfoot method is basically a point system. Essentially, you respond to a series of questions about your site, and then the system assigns different point values for your different responses. And then all you do at the end is just simply add up the points, and the total point value that you get is essentially equal to the site index for that species. And we do have the publication that describes this Baker-Broadfoot system, and it's on the link on your computer screen. Most of our landowners, most forest landowners, probably will need assistance from their land management advisor, whether it's a forestry consultant or a county forester. They probably need some assistance in order to use the system accurately, because it does require a basic knowledge of soil science. But we do strongly encourage all the landowners who are contemplating planting hardwoods to get a hold of this publication and to give it to their advisor and to use the method so that we can correctly put the right species on the right site.
Okay. And once again, that's the Baker and Broadfoot method.
Correct.
Thank you, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
The economics of growing forest land is a matter of balancing the risks with the rewards. The rewards are apparent to most of our listeners, but what are the risks? To identify some of these risks, we're joined by Ken Zedius with Resource Management Service, a forestry consulting firm. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks.
You've published an article, Ken, recently that identified some of the risks inherent in forest land, and one of the risks you identified is what you called natural risks. What is natural risk, and how can I minimize it?
Well, we could say natural risks are those events that occur in the absence of man's activity, and they are related back to a variety of factors, generally weather-related. We might think about fusiform infection as one example, a disease that's endemic throughout parts of the South. We think about southern pine beetle. We think about lightning and wildfires, and we think about glaze storms and all that sort of thing, hurricane damage. All these risks have defined areas of occurrence, but where they occur in any one particular locality within that defined area of occurrence is pretty much at random. So if you've got a forest that's spread out over the South, you have different risk hazards that might occur depending upon its geographic location. And if you're trying to minimize those risks, probably the best way to do that is maybe to think about maintaining diversity of that forest. Don't try to let it be all the same thing. A young forest is susceptible to some events, and an older forest is susceptible to other ones. If your forest is all in one geographic area and it's all young or it's all old, it's probably at a greater degree of risk for that particular event than it might be where you to have maintained a balance of age classes. That way, if you have some damage, it only affects a smaller portion of it. So think about age class diversity as a way of maintaining a degree of protection against these natural risks that I'm talking about.
So just as stock market analysts recommend diversification, so too with timber owners, both geographic and with age, that can help minimize that risk.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. One of the risks you mentioned was wildfire, and that's been a concern of many. Is that a significant concern?
Well, when it happens, it's pretty sudden, it's pretty abrupt, and it looks terrible. And particularly, you know, the media will pick up on wildfire and say, "My God, the world's coming to an end." But really, when you look at it and sit back from a population standpoint, look at the fires that occurred in Florida a few years ago, and every day we're talking about homes being destroyed, we're talking about timber being destroyed, and you got the impression the whole world was just going up in smoke. The reality of that was that if you look at the statistics and say what percent of the forest, commercial forest land in the state of Florida was burned over during that year when there was so much information put out about it, it was 0.2%. That's a pretty small number.
Mm-hmm.
And on average, if you go back since 1981, the average annual loss from wildfire in the state of Florida, including those devastating years, is less than 0.005%. So, yeah, when it happens, it's sudden, it's abrupt, it looks terrible, but the probability of it happening just, you know, on average across the South, it's pretty doggone low. It's pretty remote. There are other things that cause far more damage than fire. And these natural risks that I'm talking about, the fusiform damage, the southern pine beetle, all of that, collectively those damage and cause a heck of a lot more timber loss than fire, which seems to be so prevalent in the mind of the public.
Okay. Well, thank you for that, Ken. We appreciate it. The risks that Ken mentioned certainly figure into the mind of a banker who finances timberland. Our next guest is such a banker, Willie Dunn. Welcome, Willie.
Thanks.
Willie, I wondered what your perspective was on whether an individual should consider owning timberland as an investment.
Well, hey, I'm really excited about forest land as an investment because I am a forest land owner, and because when you compare forest land owner investments and the rate of return you get, it's not nearly about as high as mutual funds or the stock market. But you know, there are some additional benefits you get and the amenities that you have with forest land ownership, and that's outdoor recreation and being able to manage your timber and see it grow, and the hunting and other activities that you have involved with land ownership.
Well, I suppose when folks come to see you to seek financing for a project, some of them are first-time timber owners. What can a banker do to help clarify the decisions on whether a person should buy a particular tract or not?
Well, you know, the first thing we would like for them to be able to do is, you know, to have some investment of their own, you know, cash money or other collateral, you know, investing in forest land. And, of course, we would like for them to show that they have income, you know, other than that generated from the forest land to, you know, make sure that they can pay for that. Now, those are two important factors that we have. And, of course, you know, there's some real opportunities out there in forest land ownership, especially small tracts. And, you know, producers will buy large tracts and cut the timber, and then they will parcel off the smaller tracts to individuals. So there's some opportunities out there for people to buy small tracts of timberland, and like I say, the amenities are great in owning forest land owner.
Mm-hmm. Well, looking at the other side of the equation, are there any things that you see that should be avoided by timberland owners who are considering buying timberland?
Well, you know, the first fallacy that I think, or mistake that they would have, is to expect that the timber would grow enough to, you know, make the repayment on a note. You know, if you buy 80 or 100 acres of land and expect the timber to, you know, produce enough income to repay that, you know, over the term of the loan, you've got to have another source of income to pay for it initially. But, you know, it will, the experience that I've had is that the timberland will grow you about a 5% return, so you know that is about what the bond market is at this time. So it's not a bad investment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you, Willie. Appreciate that.
Thanks.
Across Alabama, public meetings are being held to gain public comment for a new program funded by the U.S. Forest Service called Legacy, preserving forest land by using federal funds to buy it or to buy certain rights to it. The need for such a program is being assessed right now. and here to offer a perspective is R.J. Smith with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Welcome, R.J.
Well, thank you, Hayes. And as a institution that supports free markets and private property rights, it sounds to me like this federal government's offer to preserve timberland by buying it is certainly an oxymoron, if I ever heard of one. I mean, because the next thing it's going to lead to is burning down those lands. I mean, I don't think we need more government-owned land. I think we need less government-owned land.
Well, the programs such as this have, I guess there are numerous ones all across the nation. What is the effect of having land owned by no one in particular?
Well, I mean, we can see what happens. I mean, when you look at the millions and millions of acres of government-owned forest land across the country that are dead or dying because it's almost impossible to get in and fight insect infestations or disease, because since it is so-called public land, the greens can get in and stop any efforts to fight disease or fight insects. They can get in and stop any efforts to salvage the timber that's there. And we end up with a situation in which we see our forest land and our wildlife habitat burning down. It's almost like with government ownership of land, we're now in a race to the bottom to see who can do the worst job. I mean, I've been unbelievably impressed by going around and visiting private land ownership in America, and particularly looking at the private forest landowners, the American Tree Farm System, Forest Landowners Association, and see what appears to me to be a continuous race to the top. With every year they're having contests to see in each state and each region and nationally who can be the tree farmer of the year, the forest landowner of the year. I mean, they're all trying to combine best available forestry practices with the private provision of public environmental amenities, creating wildlife habitat on their land, hunting opportunities for waterfowl, wild turkey, bobwhite, white-tailed deer, and creating habitat for those species creates habitat for non-game and endangered species.
Well, if you had the chance to speak with someone who might consider voluntarily placing his land in this type of program, what would you say to him?
I would tell him to really think twice about it, and look at how he can work with private associations to better manage and protect his land that way, and all the opportunities that he has of offering the public the possibility of hunting leases or hunting rights on the land. And the opportunity in many places where landowners now have good populations of non-game and endangered species, bird watchers to come in and see those. I think this would also be a bad thing for the hunting and fishing community, because as the forests deteriorate under government management, and particularly as the Greens use their power to close roads or have roads removed and bring suits to halt hunting and recreation and multiple use in the forest, I think you'll end up with less opportunities for hunting.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you, RJ. We appreciate it. Reducing taxes ranks high on the priority list of many forest owners. In this forum, we've discussed many tax tips. But one you probably haven't heard of yet is the topic of our next guest, Paul Spillers. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks.
You're a tax attorney, and I understand that recreational use is now a source of generating tax savings. Can you tell us how that works?
Well, an individual landowner who's growing timber is his primary objective may want to hunt on the land himself, and if he's doing that, there's probably no real tax benefits associated with using his property for recreation, because that activity would be deemed a hobby. He's not pursuing hunting for profit motive. He's simply pursuing it simply for his own personal pleasure. However, consider the same landowner who organizes his property to lease it to others who come in and hunt or watch birds or do whatever they want to for recreation on his property. He's then using his property not just for growing trees, but he's generating income from the use of his property as recreational property. when he does that, the property is the recreational use is converted from a hobby into a business, and that's the key. Once the recreational use is a business where he has a profit motive, that opens up the door to numerous tax advantages.
Okay, what are some of those if one finds themselves in the business of providing leasing opportunities?
There are several. Perhaps one of the most significant is the depreciation on the trees. To highlight this, if you're growing trees for timber, we all know that you cannot depreciate the trees. What you do is accumulate your cost basis, and then when you cut those trees, there's a depletion deduction that is claimed, and that's the benefit. When you cut the trees, you get a depletion deduction. On the other hand, if these trees are being used to attract wildlife, for example, mass-producing hardwoods, those trees are being used in a trade or business, recreational land. Once a tree is used in a trade or business, it becomes depreciable. And you can estimate the useful life of that tree. How long is that oak tree going to continue to produce acorns? It may be 20 years, 30 years, whatever it is. Then you set that up on a depreciation schedule and can claim a pro rata share of the cost basis over that period of time.
Okay, so it looks like depreciation, the concept of depreciation, follows the concept of being in the trade or business and allows tax savings each year.
It does.
As opposed to depletion, if you're simply in the hobby of growing timber or if you're in the timber market, that's a whole different concept.
If you're in the business of producing trees for timber, then you cannot depreciate the trees. You must deplete them, and you don't get the deduction until you cut the trees.
Okay. Well, thank you for that comment on the recreational land use and how it can generate tax savings. We appreciate it, Paul.
Thank you.
For those of you who still have both of your thumbs, we've learned of a publication known as Sawmill and Woodlot Magazine, a publication for those who'd like to get into the business of running a small sawmill. We're pleased to welcome Andy Henson from Bangor, Maine. Welcome, Andy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Tell us about this magazine, Sawmill and Woodlot Magazine. How can it help small woodlot owners?
Well, our magazine is really for people who want to take care of their forest resources, saw up their lumber, and maybe produce some income by sawing. Even if you've been at it for a while, as you know, it can be pretty overwhelming trying to manage woodlands on your own. And the whole idea behind our magazine is to give people advice they can really put to use. For example, the issue that we've just published, our August issue, looks at how to grade hardwood logs, how to edge lumber, how to install culverts, and even how to reduce the risk of wildfire, which is something that one of the earlier speakers talked about. When you're talking about managing your land, buying and selling timber, sawing and grading, drying lumber, you really need good information to make the right decisions. And, of course, one of the most popular things we do is our portable mill reviews. We have independent reviewers go out and run the machines in the field and then report back for our readers.
So you're analyzing different types of machinery and making highlighting the differences in those.
Right. It's a great way to get a look at what a particular mill can offer for you. And actually, we've now expanded that where we're doing reviews of small forestry equipment as well, like forwarders, log arches, log trailers, and that's really exciting too.
Now, y'all have taken this also one step further. I think you have something called a great portable sawmill shootout. Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's right. It's an annual competition that we do. It's a lot of fun. It's the biggest portable mill competition in the country, and we run that every May here at the Northeast Forest Products Expo. And what we do is we get mills together from all over the world, actually, and they compete for best production, best lumber recovery. And you want to have your ear protection on during the contest, but it's a lot of fun watching it. And actually, we put out a special issue each year covering that shootout. And anybody who wants to call the toll-free number on the site, we'll be happy to send them a free copy of that issue.
All right. Well, great. Well, thank you, Andy. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
If you're wondering what the timber market looks like, we have a guest that can help you. In our markets chair is Keith Balter with Resource Information Systems. Hello, Keith.
Hi, Hayes. How are you today?
Fine. Your company tracks the timber market. Why has there been such a weakness in the southern region in the timber market over the past year?
Well, the most prominent reason is that we have seen a downturn in the overall economy. But in addition to that, there's been factors that have been at work for quite a bit longer. When you look at timber prices, southern timber prices, you actually had seen them reach a cyclical peak at the beginning of 1998. And that's a time when the economy and housing markets were very, very strong. And since that time, we've seen southern pine saw timber set back from peak levels of about $365 per thousand board foot to where they are today, about at least $100 below that in the 270s. Over that same period, we've seen pulpwood prices for southern pine drop from $22 a cord, or rather $36 a cord, down to about half that level, so at $17 to $18 a cord. Part of the reason, as I mentioned more recently, has been the slowdown in the economy and the impact that's had on the pulp and paper industry. But even before that, we've seen markets having become very competitive. On the lumber side, a lot of that had to do with competition from Canada, but also from other areas of the world. The U.S. South, with the rising prices for timber that we experienced in the 1990s, really lost its edge against other supplying regions, both here in North America and also globally.
Well, are there any factors out there that you see on the horizon that could change this situation?
Well, I think that we are hoping and really anticipating that the overall economy is going to be improving as we look out over a six-month period, and that should help revive the pulp and paper industry. On the other hand, even a revival in the economy is probably not going to have a major impact on housing markets. Housing is actually at very decent levels now, given the low interest rate. But I think in terms of saw timber markets and the solid wood industry, probably the single largest factor that could turn them around would be placing some sort of trade constraint on Canadian lumber. And just the other day, we did have a ruling from the Commerce Department looking at placing, recommending a preliminary tariff on Canadian lumber of about 20%. 19.2%, and that would have a positive impact. On the other hand, as I mentioned, we are looking at a lot more competition from other supply regions. Imports, U.S. imports of non-Canadian softwood lumber since the mid-1990s have risen from about 400 million board feet per year up to about 1.2. That's what we're expecting to be the number this year, 1.2 billion board feet. That's more than a doubling, and we really do see the prospects for those imports from non-Canadian sources to continue to rise.
Okay, and that should help the market then, right? All right, well, we appreciate that very much. Thank you, Keith.
Thank you.
Well, that's all the time we have for this edition. We offer our thanks to Jim Gober, Steve Meadows, Ken Zedius, Willie Dunn. Thanks also to R.J. Smith, Paul Spillers, Andy Henson, and Keith Balter. We've heard some good news from those evaluating the current condition of the forest in Alabama. The Chicken Littles, who 10 years ago predicted that increased demand from chip mills would denude the landscape, are now nowhere to be found. And that wasn't the first time that exaggerated claims about the demise of the forest have proven untrue. As early as 1865, Frederick Starr predicted a national famine of wood, a phrase that alarmed many, given the national dependence on wood as an essential material for domestic and industrial use. The response was to reverse a three-century-old policy of passing public domain land to private use. Fortunately for Alabama, most of its land had already passed into private hands, and thus has for generations been available for productive use. that land continues to be an engine of growth today, enriching families, producing good citizens, and providing raw materials to improve the standard of living of millions throughout the nation. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us on this issue of Capital Ideas Live.